exemptions, which expand access to the programs, would also end in 2030. A Republican aide told me that they expect the overall number of people now subject to work requirements to be lower than what the original GOP proposal would have done because of the phase-in and the exemptions. I asked President Biden what his response was to Democrats being concerned that this policy could lead to more people going hungry because of the age limit increase, and he said that was a ridiculous assertion.
Okay. Now, I know last Friday, the Treasury Department said June 5th, that's a week from today, as the date the country would default. Will that be averted now?
There's still a long road to passage, but Biden and McCarthy keep saying that they're confident they will get their members on board. Here's President Biden talking to reporters last night.
That agreement now goes to the United States House and to the Senate. I strongly urge both chambers to pass that agreement.
The timeline to avoid a default remains tight. McCarthy has vowed that House members would get 72 hours to review any legislation before a vote. The bill text released last night starts that clock. So the soonest a vote can come is May 31st, 5 days before the country is set to default on its loans. After that, the bill would head to the Senate for a vote on final passage and then to the president to sign.
All right. That's NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thanks for breaking all this down.
Thank you.
What does it take to reach a deal like this one, brokered by Democrats and Republicans? Let's turn to Kenneth Feinberg. He's been involved in resolving some of the nation's most protracted and emotional disputes. Notably, he served as special master and independent arbiter for the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. So these debt and spending negotiations were conducted behind closed doors. If you could paint a picture for us of what a difficult negotiation looks like this one.
Well, a difficult negotiation is defined as a negotiation involving a major issue under the gun of a time frame.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you had here. There was a deadline. One can feint and parry and sort of keep your powder dry until you approach what everyone agrees upon is a very important deadline to get the negotiations finished. And that's exactly what occurred here under the wire, with people negotiating behind closed doors, knowing that they either get a deal or there are serious consequences.
Yeah, and in that time period, Democrats accused Republicans of holding the country hostage. Republicans said Democratic spending was to blame. How much of the trading of accusations, the multiple breakdowns in the negotiations, how much of that was a show?
Well, I wouldn't call it a show. I would call each side trying to maximize its leverage by warning the other side that there would be profound consequences. And I think that that's a standard tactic in effective negotiation, leading with your heavy armor, warning the other side that they will be to blame as to those consequences if a deal is not concluded.
Is there a magic formula for reaching these kinds of deals?
No, there's no magic wand. There are a couple of items you can check off on an agenda. There's a deadline. It's a very important issue. Do you have the right people behind those doors with the authority, the perceived authority, to cut the deal? Very important. Each side is only as candid as its belief that the other side has the right people there with authority to settle. Now, the big question that's open that you have raised in your show, can each side deliver?
Right.
You know, it's very important that people believe that when you negotiate, you have authority to deliver as a result of the negotiations. And we will see over the next day or two whether the administration and the Republican Congress can deliver on this negotiated settlement.
On that note, what would your advice to Republicans and Democrats be right now as they try to get their colleagues on board to pass through this through Congress quickly?
What's the alternative? I mean, you delegated to us the authority to negotiate. We've done that negotiation. We believe we have a pretty good barometer as to what you'll accept. And we've negotiated under the shadow of that authority. Now, for you now to tell us at the 11th hour and 59th minute that we can't deliver, our credibility will be seriously undercut.
Does this deal strike you as a genuine compromise, or did one side get more out of it than the other?
Oh, I think it's a genuine compromise. You know, in an effective negotiation, you walk away saying, I didn't get all that I wanted. I gave up an awful lot. But at the end of the day, the reasonable parties reached an agreement.
Kenneth Feinberg is an attorney specializing in conflict resolution. Thank you for your time and your insights.
Thank you.
Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is set to continue his run as Turkey's longest-serving leader.
Amid high inflation and despite having faced widespread anger at his government's response to a devastating earthquake this year, Erdogan won Sunday's runoff with 52% of the vote.
NPR's Peter Kenyon joins us from Istanbul to talk about this. Peter, Erdogan's showing in both rounds of this election surprised a lot of people, but not Erdogan and his supporters. So what did the president have to say about that last night?
Well, he spoke at the presidential palace in Ankara, and he tried to shift to a more positive tone, saying, for instance, no one lost today. But after running a campaign filled with sharp rhetoric, he couldn't resist slipping in a reference to Kurdish militants that Turkey's been battling for decades, who he's been accusing the opposition of cooperating with. Erdogan made a point of mentioning their stronghold in Kandil in northern Iraq. Well, here's a bit of what he said. Now, besides attacking the Kurdish fighters, he's saying, we love Turkey so much, how could this nation not be loved? And now he also made multiple references to brotherly love, positive times ahead, but it was pretty clear that Erdogan has lost none of his combative leadership style. And throughout this campaign, Erdogan has continued to attract a loyal following that continues to back him despite the hardships of recent years. And hearing their leader celebrate another victory, that was all music to the ears of his supporters.
The thing is, though, there are still millions of people homeless in an area that was struck by an earthquake. How did he do there?
Well, he did quite well even there. Initial results show Erdogan ahead in 9 of the 11 provinces most affected by the February earthquake that killed some 50,000 people. Comments from voters there suggest, despite the fact that there's widespread anger at the government's sluggish response to the earthquake and its role in allowing contractors to build unsafe buildings in an earthquake area in the first place, they still thought Erdogan was a better bet to reconstruct the region and get people back into homes.
Is there a sense at all, Peter, that the opposition maybe chose the wrong candidate to send up against Erdogan?
There will, of course, be debate along those lines. It's already started. A coalition of six parties settled on 74-year-old Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, the head of the main secular party, as their candidate. He has an impeccable reputation for honesty, never linked to a political scandal, but there has also been a sense for years that Kılıçdaroğlu never quite had the charisma, the political appeal to defeat Erdogan and his ruling party. These days, the opposition mayors of both Istanbul and Ankara are seen as more popular, stronger candidates. And there's been some grumbling that Kılıçdaroğlu's insistence that it was his turn to run cost the opposition what might have been its best chance to unseat Erdogan.
Now, I know their congratulations for Erdogan are pouring in from capitals around the world. What are people saying about what maybe another 5 years of Erdogan's leadership might mean for Turkey's relations with the rest of the world?
That is a big topic, and that'll be playing out for some time. Some people are hoping with this victory, Erdogan might consider returning to the reformist ways he started out with earlier in his tenure. But others point out, after failing to get Turkey admitted to the European Union years ago, Erdogan has been looking to the east. He's developed strong ties with Russia. That concerns Washington and others. One question now is, will Erdogan press forward with a more eastward-looking foreign policy? And if so, what'll that mean for Turkey's longstanding role as a solid NATO ally in this dangerous neighborhood?
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Istanbul. Peter, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Alex Crow. Glad to be with you at 8:19 on this Memorial Day Monday. Coming up here on the program, we have plenty of stuff still to get to. We'll hear about Chris Carosa, the editor of Hamburger Dreams, talking about the origins of the hamburger itself. Plus, coming up a little bit later on, we will hear a story about the Texas State Senate and how they could hold an impeachment vote to removal from office vote for their attorney general. All that coming up on WPR.
There are 1,163 Wisconsinites listed on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. View their photos in Wisconsin Remembers, A Face for Every Name, an exhibit developed by WPR, PBS Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Veterans Museum.
This Memorial Day, see Wisconsin Remembers in Madison, Kaukauna, and Bloomer. Learn more at WPR.org/veterans.
Support for WPR comes from U.S. Venture in Appleton, working to be an innovative global energy leader dedicated to clean energy and a sustainable future. More information is at usventure.com. Finding a better way.
Support for WGTD comes from the Racine Theater Guild, presenting Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, a darkly delicious musical thriller, May 19th through June 4th. More information is available online at racinetheater.org.
Joining us for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Alex Crow. A nice day today with highs in the 70s and 80s, more of the same expected tomorrow. On Wednesday, even warmer with highs in the 80s and 90s. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from HBO. Sydney Sweeney stars in the new HBO original film, Reality, based on the story of Reality Winner, who went from working for the NSA to being interrogated by the FBI. Premieres tonight at 10 p.m. on Max. From Workday, committed to helping organizations adapt to change using real-time data to uncover insights, stay decision-ready, and prepare for whatever's next, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. And from the United States Postal Service, reinventing its network with shipping options designed to keep businesses moving forward. USPS, delivering for America. USPS.com/movingforward.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. In the early part of the 20th century, the Great Migration saw millions of African Americans leave the South for urban areas in the North. Now a new study sheds light on another Great Migration. Between 1900 and 1940, about 5 million white Southerners also left the region. And the study shows how the political and cultural influence of this migration continues to be felt today. My colleague Michelle Martin spoke to Samuel Bazzi, one of the authors of the study. He's also an associate professor at the University of California, San Diego. Bazzi started out talking about where these migrants landed.
They really did settle all over the United States. And while they did go to places in, say, the Northeast and kind of the economic heartland, at least in the early part of the 20th century, they went there, in, at least in relative numbers, much less than they did to places out in the Western United States. One important fact that really distinguishes the Southern white diaspora from the Southern black diaspora in many ways is that the white diaspora really could be found across the density divide. They settled in very rural places, in small towns, in big towns, in big cities, whereas the black diaspora is really concentrated in some of the biggest cities, the most dense places in urban America.
So that's fascinating. One of the things that I think is most striking, and one of the things that's gotten a lot of attention, is that you set forth the theory that this white Southern diaspora has had a really profound effect on the country's politics. Tell us why.
The first kind of important fact really stems from the point that I just highlighted, which is that they were really geographically diffuse. And so why is that important in the American electoral system? Well, our electoral college really overrepresents low-density places, low-population states, relative to higher population places and states.
Well, just to clarify for folks, so South Dakota has the same two senators as California. So there's that. What else?
That's right. So that's really key. And then in the other is the fact that these migrants, in many ways, really did bring new or at least intensified forms of religious conservatism to new parts of the country. They brought evangelical Protestantism from the American South and brought that with them to many places across America. and evangelical Christianity becomes much more politically engaged as a voting bloc and really mobilized in the 1970s. That's certainly one really important feature. And then the other is racial conservatism. And so if you look at survey data from the 1950s, 1960s, you can see that the Southern white diaspora looks much more similar in terms of their racial attitudes to the white populations living in the South as compared to those living in the rest of the country.
Do you think that the influence of this group was mainly that they settled in places that weren't as populous, so they kind of had an outsized impact? Or do you think they influenced their neighbors?
So I think we certainly find evidence of that outsized impact in these places that are less populous. But the other thing that we find is that indeed there does seem to be a very kind of localized intergroup contact. You may be going to the same church every Sunday. Your children may be going to the same schools. So I think there are kind of a lot of really localized neighborhood-based channels through which these migrants could be influencing their neighbors. One thing that we do see quite clearly in the data is that, just to give you a concrete example, take a non-Southern white individual. If they are moving to a community where there happens to be a large Southern white migrant population, what we actually are able to see is that when you're exposed to that Southern white diaspora among your very local neighbors, you begin to give your children more religious names and tend to send a strong signal to others of your religiosity.
So let me be clear again that your report is based on statistical data. Can you tell us why you're so convinced that you can draw conclusions about the influence of this migration in the early 20th century on election results decades later?
The first is that we're indeed focused on that early wave of mass migration of whites out of the South in the early 1900s. And we're detecting a kind of impact on politics and a rightward shift in the communities to which they're migrating as early as the 1960s. And of course, the 1960s were this kind of critical juncture in American politics as conservatives really realigned behind the Republican Party. And we saw the kind of mass exodus of Southern white voters from the Democratic Party. We also see that they begin to lose voters from the Southern white diaspora outside the South and the communities in which that diaspora had begun to build deep roots in the middle of the 20th century. And then, of course, as partisan politics have really calcified in America, we've really seen the imprint of that diaspora persisting all the way through to the last, say, 5 or 6 presidential elections.
Before we let you go, where do you want to take this research next?
What we're doing is really digging deeply into the immediate post-Civil War era and basically looking at the migration of white individuals out of the former Confederate states and tracking those migrants who grew up living in an economy that was governed by slavery. They really played an important role in diffusing Confederate culture, Confederate nostalgia outside of the American South, and helped grow and mobilize white supremacy in new forms in many places outside of the American South.
So why you might see a Confederate flag in places you don't expect.
Precisely.
Samuel Bazzi is the researcher and writer on the paper we've been talking about. It's titled The Other Great Migration, Southern Whites and the New Right. Thanks so much for talking with us and sharing this really, really interesting research with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
While pharmaceutical companies are known as the main driver of the opioid crisis, some experts say it's become a political issue on a global scale because of fentanyl production outside of the U.S.
We should not shy away from indicting Chinese and Mexican officials and businessmen complicit in the illegal trade or in subverting cooperation.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news, today from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Alex Crow. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Biden will spend part of his Memorial Day at Arlington National Cemetery. The president will take part in a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier before making remarks. The president and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy are urging lawmakers to support their compromise agreement to raise the debt ceiling and avoid a default. The two reached a deal over the weekend. It includes caps on federal spending over the next 2 years. A vote in the House is expected on Wednesday. Officials in Kyiv are reporting more Russian airstrikes against targets in Ukraine today. NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kharkiv says there were several injuries, but no deaths.
Russia has attacked Kyiv more than a dozen times this month alone. Early this morning, the Ukrainian military says it shot down more than 40 missiles and drones over Kyiv overnight. And yesterday, on the day Kyiv celebrated its 1,541st birthday, Russia launched a record number of drones at the city. And these are powerful Shahed drones made by Iran.
That's NPR's Joanna Kakissis. Ukrainian officials say its port in Odessa was hit by a Russian airstrike, causing damage and a fire. There's no trading today on Wall Street because of the Memorial Day holiday. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. An initiative to put Narcan and fentanyl test strips into the hands of first responders in Milwaukee is underway. Evan Casey has more.
Drug overdose deaths have hit record highs in Milwaukee County for 4 years in a row. Now, first responders can access kits that contain Narcan, a nasal mist that can reverse an overdose. Amanda De Leon is with Community Medical Services, a treatment facility for those who suffer from substance abuse. She says overdoses tend to trend up in the summer.
This is the perfect time to get Narcan into the hands of these folks that need it the most, and giving them more options on where to get it.
The majority of overdose deaths are due to fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine. The kits also contain fentanyl test strips, CPR masks, and information about treatment. Milwaukee police recently joined the effort, which was launched last year with the Milwaukee Fire Department and Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
After 100 years in the city, Master Lock will close its Milwaukee manufacturing facility next year. The company plans to move production elsewhere in North America by next March. About 400 people will be out of a job. The decision has drawn criticism from unions and city leaders. The mayor called it a, quote, slap in the face. It comes as a new report from the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce highlights the importance Milwaukee manufacturing plays in the industry across the state. Metro Milwaukee's manufacturing workforce makes up more than one-fifth of the sector's Wisconsin labor pool. It also accounts for more than a quarter of the industry's GDP in the state. Buckley Brinkman is an industry consultant.
It's always been a critical part of the manufacturing ecosystem.
The industry is the second biggest employer in Milwaukee and its suburbs. The area also has the second highest concentration of people working in manufacturing in the country. In weather today, nice day in store for the state with highs in the 70s and 80s and plenty of sunshine. Tomorrow, another nice day in store. However, wind will expect it to start pick up. That's because even warmer temperatures move in Wednesday with highs in the 80s and 90s. Could see some scattered showers in some parts of the state as well. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hint, maker of fruit-infused water with no sugar or diet sweeteners. Available in more than 25 flavors, including watermelon and pineapple. In stores or delivered from hintwater.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society.
More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Faldil in Washington, D.C. Ken Paxton, the Republican Attorney General of Texas, has been suspended from his duties as he awaits a trial before the state Senate. This follows a vote by the GOP-led State House of Representatives to impeach him over allegations of bribery, abuse of office, and other misconduct. Sergio Martinez Beltran, who covers politics for the Texas Newsroom, was in the House chamber during that vote on Saturday, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Hi, Leila.
Hi. So what was the mood like in that chamber during the vote?
Well, it was very somber. The whole impeachment vote lasted about 4 hours. Members of the House General Investigating Committee laid out the evidence against Attorney General Paxton. And, you know, this is a bipartisan panel. So both Republicans and Democrats went into detail over Paxton's alleged misdeeds involving one of his political donors. And one of the big accusations is that Paxton used the office of the Attorney General to intervene in an FBI investigation against his friend. He even hired an outside attorney for this, despite his staff telling him not to. And a reminder that Paxton was indicted by federal authorities in 2015 and still hasn't gone to trial yet. Some of these articles of impeachment are related to that. Now, we should mention some Republican members raised concerns about the whole process, but didn't defend Paxton, which I thought was interesting to hear.
Yeah, now only a simple majority was needed, but most Texas House members voted to impeach, right?
Right. 121 members voted in favor of the 20 articles of impeachment against Attorney General Ken Paxton. So that means nearly all Democrats and most Republicans. I talked to Texas State Representative Ann Johnson. She's a Democrat who serves on the House General Investigating Committee. She says she's not surprised to see so many members of both parties vote this way.
Public integrity is not partisan. And this was an overwhelming vote to recognize that the top cop was on the take, engaged in, as accused, issues of bribery, public corruption, official abuses, abuse of capacity, and so many other potential state crimes.
Again, Johnson is a Democrat, but Republicans have also said Paxton has acted like he's above the law. One of the Republican members even said from the House floor that Paxton had called members and threatened them with political consequences in their next election if they voted to impeach.
Now, we should note that Paxton has denied any allegations of wrongdoing and has lashed out against the impeachment proceedings in the Texas House, calling it a sham, illegal. And as you point out, though, many of his fellow Republicans are part of this impeachment process in agreement. What do we expect to happen now that it goes to a state Senate trial?
So first, the House would have to select members to serve as impeachment managers in the trial, and they would be presenting the case in the Senate. And then that chamber will then conduct a trial, and senators will have to decide whether to convict Paxton. Now, the threshold in the Senate is higher. A two-third vote is needed to convict. And it's important to note, Leila, that Ken Paxton's wife, Angela Paxton, is a state senator, and she's required to be in attendance. Now it's unclear if she will recuse herself.
And how rare is it to see impeachment proceedings like this in Texas?
Really rare. Only two other public officials have been impeached in Texas history, a governor in 1917 and a judge in 1976. And this issue is also rare because Paxton is beloved by Republican voters. He's friends with former President Donald Trump and was a prominent election denier, even trying to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. So all of this is historic, it's unprecedented, and quite frankly, it's pretty wild.
Sergio Martinez Beltran covers politics for the Texas Newsroom. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Climate change is increasing the fire risk on the mostly treeless Great Plains. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports on efforts to get prairie dwellers to adapt to the new reality.
Home builder Josh Poser lives in the small town of Denton, surrounded by the grasslands of eastern Montana. The last thing he thought he'd be doing is fighting a wildfire in December. But that's exactly what happened a couple of years ago as 70-mile-an-hour winds pushed flames across 10,000 acres.
Late that night, you know, we're putting some embers out in the yard and sprinkler on the roof, and they had patrols going all over the place.
Overnight, flames consumed Poser's house and 24 others. Don Pyra is with Montana's State Fire Agency. He says firefighters were quickly overwhelmed because unusually there was no snow on the ground in December, and it was way too warm.
And it was 56 degrees in the middle of the night. That's not normal.
Researchers say the warming climate means more dry Decembers and a lot less snow cover across the Great Plains, meaning a lot more fire risk during a typically windier time of the year. University of Florida researcher Victoria Donovan led a 2017 study that found fire activity on the Great Plains has increased by 3.5 times in recent decades. She says that a century of fire suppression has also allowed more trees and woody vegetation to grow, making fires more intense.
There's a lot more opportunities for these wildfires to occur and also for them to be a lot more destructive.
That kind of research isn't really embraced in conservative eastern Montana. Official growth policy in the county that had the big fire explicitly opposes President Biden's 2021 executive order on climate change. Mike DeVries is chief of the volunteer fire department in Denton, the town of 200 that was burned over a couple of Decembers ago.
I mean, I grew up in Montana and I know we've been through droughts. I don't know that people just attribute it to one thing.
But DeVries acknowledges that fire was well outside the norm.
That was by far the most active and unbelievable year that we'd ever had.
Anna Capela with Montana State Fire Agency is trying to help people better prepare their homes for fires. She says it's a tougher sell out here than in more forested parts of the state.
You can blame climate change, the drought, whatever you want to blame, but it ultimately starts with people's homes.
Capela will make suggestions for property owners like shifting to metal roofs and less flammable building materials or cutting back trees and shrubs near their home. But there's been little interest so far.
I feel like that's people's beauty, that's people's paradise.
But Josh Poser, who lost his house in the December fire, is still living with his family in a camper. He takes the threat of another wildfire more seriously now. Standing inside the unfinished walls of the new home he hopes to finish this fall, he says they are building in a more fire-resilient way to avoid losing their home again.
There will be concrete siding, metal roof. Before we had, everything was wood. Wood windows, wood siding, wood everything. So it was a recipe for disaster.
Those are exactly the kind of changes state fire managers would like to see more people on the Great Plains make. They're hoping others will be more likely to do the same if they see their neighbor do it first. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Denton, Montana.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Alex Crow. Glad to be with you at 8:42 on this Memorial Day Monday. Well, because it's Memorial Day, a special story about military widows and widowers coming up. Did you know that if they remarry, they could lose their benefits if they remarry before the age of 55? We'll have a story about that and attempts to end the remarriage penalty coming up here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You tune into Wisconsin Public Radio for news you can trust, conversations that draw you in, and music and entertainment that make your day better. The largest source of funding for everything you value on WPR is listener support. Join the team that makes WPR possible. Become a sustaining member. Make an ongoing monthly gift and share WPR with your entire community. It's easy to sign up at WPR.org.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Mead Witter Foundation of Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin, supporting the activities of the citizens of central and northern Wisconsin and encouraging support of Wisconsin Public Radio programming.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the City of Kenosha is preparing to open the 2023 pool season in mid-June, and season pool passes are now available for purchase for use at the city's two public swimming pools at Anderson Park and Washington Park. For more info, visit kenosha.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:44. Here's some of what's happening in the news. President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy say they've come to an agreement on raising the nation's debt ceiling. The measure must now pass through both chambers of Congress. Turkey's incumbent President Erdogan has been reelected in the country's runoff vote. He's been president there since 2014. The state will add a half mile of shoreline to the Rural River State Forest, expanding public access to Lake Superior and protecting habitat for an endangered shorebird. And Madison's middle and high school students will again have free access to city bus passes this summer. In weather, a nice day today with highs in the 70s and 80s and plenty of sunshine. More of the same tomorrow. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher Investments' team of specialists tailor portfolios to each client's long-term goals. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investments in securities involve the risk of loss. And from the Nature Conservancy, partnering with communities across the globe to find solutions to the climate and biodiversity crises. Committed to building a future where people and nature can thrive. Nature.org/solutions. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. For military widows and widowers, getting married again can be costly. Federal rules cut off benefits to widows and widowers who get remarried before the age of 55. Joining us now is Military Times reporter Leo Shane III. Leo, can you give us an idea of how much a veteran surviving spouse stands to lose if they remarry before 55?
Yeah, it's quite a bit of money. I mean, these military survivor benefits can be generous. So we're talking anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars a year. That can total up to over $40,000, $50,000 a year. So it's a real financial burden for these families.
Yeah, and these rules can lead to something that you call relationship limbo. Tell us what relationship limbo means.
Yeah, basically these spouses, after they've lost a loved one, they go through the grieving process. If they want to move on and get remarried to a new boyfriend or girlfriend, they've got to make these financial decisions. They've got to decide whether or not their love outweighs that kind of big financial burden that comes in. I mean, it seems cruel, but to ask someone, hey, is it really worth marrying this person if you're going to lose $40,000 a year? It just puts these spouses who've already gone through so much into an awkward position.
Yeah, what a tough choice deciding between love and money in this case. Yeah, and you interviewed a woman who went through this. Her husband was in the Army, and then he took his own life when she was just 24 years old. What happened when she eventually decided to remarry?
Yeah, her name is Rebecca Morrison Mullaney, and I actually spoke to her years ago before she had gotten remarried, trying to make these decisions, trying to understand, you know, what exactly this would be. Ultimately, she did decide that she wanted to move ahead with having a family, you know, raising a new family, having a new husband. But it cost her $42,000 a year to do this. And now she's on Capitol Hill talking to lawmakers saying, look, this just isn't fair. This feels like you're saying that I'm all settled and that this first marriage never happened. You're erasing my husband, Ian, who I loved and wanted to stay with, but couldn't because of circumstances. So it's not just the money. It's also the feeling that the government's saying, well, this is over now. This is settled. And frankly, his service didn't count. His service is gone.
I mean, it just sounds like these rules are keeping military widows and widowers from getting remarried.
Yeah, and that's what's happening in a lot of cases here. You know, we talked to folks over at the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. They've been tracking this for a while. They said only about 5% of surviving military spouses under the age of 55 get remarried because of these financial penalties. After 55, you do see quite a few spouses who will step in, who've been in long-term relationships, who've sort of kept their relationships hidden from the government just to keep doing this. But this could impact, you know, upwards of 60,000, 65,000 families across the country who are just looking to move on with their lives.
Yeah, and you write that legislation recently introduced maybe might address this issue. Tell us about the Love Lives On Act.
Yeah, this is the latest attempt to try and fix this problem. It simply would remove that penalty, allow these spouses to get remarried before 55. So it's already been introduced in both the House and the Senate. It's got support from Republicans and Democrats, and we'll see if there's some support for it this year.
All right, that's Military Times reporter Leo Shane III. Leo, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Alex Crow with you at 8:49 on this Monday, Memorial Day Monday. Well, coming up, we've still got some more Morning Edition here on the way. News at the top of the hour. Next hour, Stephanie Elkins is in, and Morning Classics will be with you as well. All of that coming up here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Marketplace comes from Offsite, an infrastructure and IT services company. Offsite provides managed cybersecurity services to help protect your IT infrastructure, both on-premises and in the cloud. Visit off-site.com/radio.
nr.wisconsin.gov/phishing.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Alex Crow. In sports, the Brewers got a win over the Giants yesterday. The Brewers are in first place in the division, a game and a half over the Pittsburgh Pirates. In hockey, Game 6 between Las Vegas and Dallas being played tonight. That one starts at 7. In the NBA, Game 7 between the Miami Heat and Boston Celtics taking place tonight at 7:30. And speaking of the NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks are reportedly set to hire Raptors assistant Adrian Griffin as their new head coach. In weather for today, highs in the 70s and 80s, a beautiful day weather-wise for Memorial Day. Tomorrow, another nice day with highs in the 70s and 80s, and things get even warmer on Wednesday with highs in the 80s and 90s across the state. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldil. When Grammy Award-winning musician Marcy Marxer learned she had breast cancer, of course she got sad, probably moments of mad. But then she got funny.
I'm talking about my breasts, which I don't actually do generally in public. But I find when I talk about my breasts, other people think it's funny.
So Marxer and her wife, fellow Grammy winner Kathy Fink, turned Marxer's diagnosis into a musical comedy film.
I don't need pharmaceuticals or beautiful old musicals. I feel a little tipsy all the time.
All Wigged Out follows Marxer's cancer diagnosis, treatment, and recovery, a process that took 7 years. It began when Marxer took a call from her doctor while her music students strummed the song, You Are My Sunshine.
I'd had a biopsy. I was teaching the ukulele, and my doctor explained that the results were positive. And I said, positive? Positive in a negative way? Because, you know, it means something very different to a regular human than it does to a doctor.
Yeah, positive should be good.
So right away, some things about the whole medical process didn't make much sense to me.
Yeah.
They seemed a little backwards and a little bit funny and a little worth poking fun at.
So, Marcy, and I'll bring you in here too, Kathy. I mean, you get this diagnosis. I don't know what that's like to hear news like that, but I don't know that I'd be like, you know, I think this is a musical.
No, it didn't hit me quite that way in the beginning.
That took a while.
Yeah.
The first thing that you do is you kind of dig into what is it that you have to deal with.
Yeah.
And you're sort of in crisis mode.
Yeah.
And then we started needing to process. And that's when the seeds of All Wigged Out came.
Part of that processing was the realization that valuable information often comes from unexpected sources, like the wig shop they visited after her doctor told Marxer she might lose her hair.
Amy's a Denmark. It's every girl's dream.
Amy of Denmark was the wig shop in Wheaton, Maryland. And when we walked in, this woman, Sandy, said, what's your diagnosis? What's your cocktail? Who's your doctor? This was all stuff she was familiar with. And
wow.
Once we gave Sandy all the information, she looked at Marcy. She said, when's your first chemo? And Marcy said, it was 2 days ago. And Sandy just looked at her and said, honey, we got to make a plan. You're going to be bald in 10 days.
Wow.
My first instinct when I found out I was for sure going to be bald, I bought some watercolor markers.
Why?
To draw on my head.
What?
For decoration, since I wasn't going to have hair.
What?
I thought maybe I'd have the neighborhood kids help me get dressed up for parties.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
One of the songs, speaking of information that came from a different source than the doctor, is a song about unsolicited advice.
Someone came up to me right after I had the biopsy. I didn't know anything. And he said, "So what are your chances?" And it scared the heck out of me. I just couldn't believe somebody would say that. You know, I was like, geez, I hope nobody asks me that again.
Yeah, that's very direct.
What I really find is if your house gets hit by lightning, people know what to say to you. It's like, "Oh, can I help? Do you need a place to stay? Do you need a blanket? Do you need some food?" But if you have cancer, people who haven't experienced it or haven't had a loved one experience cancer really don't know what to say to you. And still, they keep talking.
I don't know what to say, so I'm going to say a lot of inappropriate things.
But don't go answering questions that no one's ever asked, unsolicited advice.
A lot of the material for All Wigged Out came from cartoons, memes, and musings that Markser posted on social media.
I was supposed to keep a journal of my symptoms so I could report to the doctor. And the things I wrote down in that journal were really things like positive in a negative way. From day one, those were the kinds of things I wrote down.
Oh, so a lot of these like really sort of funny takes are from things in the moment that you said, that you observed, that you felt, that you wrote down.
Everything. So I ended up being kind of a chemo coach for a bunch of people and connecting with other people who help patients get through.
So this film is the story, Marcy, of your journey with cancer, but it's also the story of your relationship, the two of you. You've been musical partners for 40 years. You're married. At one point in your treatment, Marcy, you apologized to Kathy.
"I'm so sorry."
"What for?"
"I screwed up our lives. I don't know when or if I'll ever play music again. Do you want to go do some shows without me?"
"Definitely not. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to watch movies together. I'm going to watch you sleep.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to go to every chemo. I'm going to go to every doctor's appointment. And we're going to get through this one day at a time."
Now, your roles are a bit reversed right now. I understand, Kathy, you recently found out you have breast cancer.
I did. We are living in a little chapter that we're calling The Irony and the Ecstasy. So I'm working with our team that's promoting the film All Wigged Out, partially from my chemo chair.
Wow.
And I do have a diagnosis that is not unsimilar to Marcy's, and it has a terrific prognosis. You know, our roles are reversed, and I'll tell you, Marcy knows what to do.
Hmm.
One thing we know is patients try to live their life to the best of their abilities, and doctors are trying to save your life, and those are two very different things.
Yeah.
So we'll use humor where appropriate, where we can, but we do understand that we're in walking two lines. One is the process of making sure that Kathy's going to be fine and live a long and happy life, and the other is living our lives while we go through this.
Yeah. Kathy Fink and Marcy Markser, I don't know that I've ever used the word joy to describe a conversation about cancer, but this was really a joy. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You complete my sentence. You finish my meal. You steal my ice cream.
You aren't finishing it. That's
All Wigged Out is streaming online and available on DVD. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Mae Martinez.
We're two peas in a pod, just making life fun. You're a preacher's daughter.
Yes, I'm a shiksa, and you're a Jew. We have a mixed marriage.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us here this Memorial Day Monday. Morning Classics is on the way after the news here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, featuring over 200 water slides, scenic tours, theme parks, and more. Entertainment information at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.